This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Lawmakers in Indianapolis have passed along, and in turn, it's been signed by the governor, a new juvenile justice bill, and has some impact in Indiana on young teen offenders. Let's find out what kind of impact it might have here in Northwest Indiana and learn more from Porter County Sheriff Dave Reynolds with us today. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you for asking.
Well, from what do you understand, the measure that was authored by State Senator Karen Talion of Ogden Dunes and sponsored in part by Representative Reagan Hatcher of Gary has some interesting provisions. What do you understand that this measure is going to do for law enforcement in particular here in Northwest Indiana?
Well, I think what Senator Talion wanted to do is to there's a couple parts that she was pushing for. One is if a juvenile commits a crime, not a felony or a violent crime, that they would not be held in a jail with adults. And there was also a section, I believe, on expungement. So after a year, after the juvenile reaches an adult, that juvenile can request his record be expunged. And, you know, I don't think most law enforcement officials would have any issues with that. In Porter County, you know, it has happened where we've had juveniles in our jail, but normally it's associated with a violent crime, a murder, or something along those and that shouldn't be affected by mm-hmm. that. And still, I think everybody needs to understand it's still controlled by the judge. So the judge can make the decision on what records should be expunged and why, and where they should be held. So, but I understand the whole premise behind it. You know, it's not this law wasn't passed just because of what we're doing in Porter County. It's throughout the whole state. So who knows what's going on yeah. throughout the state. So maybe in different counties, they've had juveniles in their jail on misdemeanors and, you know, and really that's pretty much unacceptable with us. So I mean, I think it's a good. I think what Senator Talion was trying to do was, not stigmatize juveniles when they reach adulthood, to give them a chance to make it. I don't think mm-hmm. I don't think law enforcement. You know, well, we obviously no one really objected to it. The FOP this. ISA, the Indiana Sheriff Association, the chiefs of police, all supported the bill.
Do you think, Sheriff Reynolds, that maybe it's a case, because we're looking at a statewide picture here with this particular measure, do you think that maybe in some counties, and we're thinking more of smaller counties with smaller physical jails, that maybe that they have to, because of the size of the jail, they may have to mingle juveniles in together with as much, at least they can separate them, with the adult population, and maybe there is the concern there?
I mean, that's possible, but even when in Porter County, we've had, we'd have a juvenile maybe charged with murder, and they're 17.
Mm-hmm.
Now, theoretically, they're juvenile until they're waived. Even if they're in our facility, you know, we would do everything we can to separate them from, put them in a situation where they, you know, they're protected. But like you said, not every jail has that luxury of be able to do that. So I certainly believe that's what was behind this whole bill. And you know, I think it passed out of the House and Senate. Unanimously, so everybody voted
yeah.
for it. So,
do you think there's a concern that maybe, at least to some lawmakers, I'm sure it probably came out during some of the discussion when the bill was being considered, about trying to find a way to get the issue of institutional racism out of the juvenile justice system, and this was just one step in that direction?
I mean, that's possible. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, all I know is what I know in Porter County, and you know, I've never experienced that, but I know it exists. And I think, you know, a bill like this would certainly help that, you know, or prevent that from occurring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we're lucky in Porter County because our criminal justice system, they all work very well together. You know, probation, prosecutor, judges, public defenders packed. But not every county has, you know, has that luxury of that inner cooperation, you know, if you will. And so I think what they are trying to do is prevent that from happening and do whatever they can to make sure it doesn't happen.
We're talking with Porter County Sheriff David Reynolds about among other things, issues that the General Assembly took up and passed in this past session. And one of them in particular was the Juvenile Justice Bill. I know in general they've had some pretty good support for law enforcement to come out of the legislature. And this year was a good year, I understand.
Oh, absolutely. I've been involved. This is my 15th year as sheriff, and I've never seen the legislature. The General Assembly has always been receptive. But I think they really went out of their way to show, especially what is going on throughout the country with a lot of talk about defunding police. Why do we even need police? Take police out of the schools. And because of certain things that have happened in Atlanta and Minnesota and in the whole last year, we spoke with the Black Caucus group from Indiana, and we did a lot of lobbying on certain things that we'd like to see, and we heard what they wanted too. So what we did was what I got from all of these meetings was what was going on in the country wasn't happening in Indiana. They wanted to support law enforcement, and they wanted to provide the resources that we needed. And they wanted certain things. They wanted to do away with chokeholds, and we don't do chokeholds. So it was, for us, it was an easy sell. I mean, we just took it out, you know, and so they liked that. And we were all about transparency and accountability, and that's what they want. So we presented a proposal that the state would really promote body cameras and car cameras and squad cars and mm-hmm. on policemen. And I think you're going to see that actually funded in the future. Obviously, we talked about training. Our law enforcement academy up here, we use Hobart. It's a satellite of the academy, and it's very successful and very very productive for us, our law enforcement agencies up here. But down in Plainfield, that facility, you know, was built in the 70s. It's fallen apart, and they passed legislation that is actually going to give that academy about $70 million. And that will help. Obviously, it was needed. One of the problems that we've talked about in the last year or two is really the prevalence of mental health, the problem in jails. You know, it's not really overcrowdedness, and it's not COVID. It's not substance abuse. It's mental health. And we really talked a lot to the governor's office and the General Assembly. And then this year, they passed some legislation that will help us in the jail. So just the mere fact that they're listening and they're trying to respond to some of our concerns was pretty exciting for all law enforcement. That, you know, and I just believe that we're fortunate to live in this state because we have a lot of good things going on. You know, not to say that law enforcement people don't make mistakes. You know, but why should we be held accountable in Indiana and in Porter County because of some officer doing a bonehead thing in Minnesota? Mm-hmm. Okay. And I think that's what you're seeing in a lot of different states, that they're reacting to that. And in Indiana, I just didn't see it, you know, but we did sit down and address concerns. A lot of legislation was passed this last session, but it was really the result of a lot of hard work over the whole year. And it was a lot of people that were involved. People from the Indiana Sheriff Association, you know, different sheriffs, you know, met with their own legislators and the General Assembly in different committees throughout the summer. So we're very excited about what happened this year.
Well, Sheriff Reynolds, thank you for sharing time with us, telling us what you think about some of the measures and the work that the lawmakers in Indianapolis have done in this past session. And we'll look for changes as they come about. And we appreciate hearing what the Porter County view is about this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the opportunity.
This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. The recently enacted American Rescue Plan, or ARP as it's often called, allocated $17 billion in support of veterans in response to the coronavirus pandemic, as well as providing some needed monetary aid. Tom Murphy is the acting undersecretary for benefits for the Department of Veterans Affairs. He's the VA's top administrator for non-medical benefits. And he is with us to talk about some initiatives that can help transform veterans' lives in the midst of all of the economic challenges that the pandemic has brought. Mr. Murphy, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Will you refresh our memories here and tell us more about the American Rescue Plan of 2021? When was it established?
Well, the American Rescue Plan was put into law on March 11th. It does some really far-reaching thing and affects the lives of veterans, all veterans that come to the VA. Number one, provides additional funding into for the delivery of quality health care. DHA's got a lot of pent-up demand, people that put off getting things done because of COVID. Now they're starting to come back into the hospitals, and they need it. Next one is needed economic relief for veterans, and I'm talking targeted directly to the veteran himself. It helps us eliminate the claims backlog, which is built up as a result of COVID. It allows us to modernize our supply chain to improve the other three that I just talked about a moment ago. And it provides additional resources to the Board of Veterans Appeals to decrease the appeals for the veterans that have been waiting the longest to get a decision on their case.
Mm-hmm. Now, how does the ARP Act of 2021 affect a veteran's present benefits? Any effect at all?
It's a great one here. There's a targeted part of the law called the Veterans Rapid Retraining Assistance Program. This is $386 million that provides for training and employment assistance services for veterans that lost their job as a result of COVID.
Does the new law offer any new benefits since we've talked about the present ones?
Oh, the VRAP one is the one that's impacted here. This is a great new benefit.
Mm-hmm.
It gives 12 months of training for a new targeted position. It pays the tuition, it pays the fees, it provides a monthly housing allowance in the form of a stipend for the veteran while they're completing that program. It's targeted to veterans that are between the age of 22 and 67 years old, and it's got a limiting factor, and the factor is its high-demand occupation list as defined by the Department of Labor.
When you talk about high-demand jobs that makes available for unemployed veterans, any ones in particular that you can bring out, or is there a whole gamut of them that might be affected?
I was rather surprised when I saw the list. It really is a gamut, and it's the jobs that drive our economy. It can be in the trades, it could be truck driving, it could be computer programming, it could be in the business world or teaching. You really got to go take at the list and see just how broad and wide this is. So what VA did is we lined up institutions that provide training that meet the needs of that high-demand occupation list. We send the veteran to school, like I said, up to 12 months, pay all the fees, tuitions, et cetera, and at the end of it comes the best part. It's got job placement services to come along with it.
Now, we know that the GI Bill has gone through a lot of changes, a lot of transformations from its original days following World War II and the Vietnam-era veterans and the Vietnam War veterans that have been able to take advantage of it. And now, of course, post-Vietnam with the newer versions of the GI Bill. What kind of benefits are going to be taken care of with this new program that's going to be coming up here? I hear something like it's called a 90-10 loophole. What is that, and how are the changes going to be affected in that?
The 90-10 loophole is about ensuring that the veterans that use their very precious GI Bill benefits are used on a quality education that's going to do something good for the veteran. So there has to be a number of students and the revenue that comes into an institution from other than just veterans by themselves. And in this way, we ensure that it's not something that's just simply targeted as a mill to do for veterans. It adds true value and really makes the veteran's life better in the end. So the 90-10 rule helps protect veterans in that way.
Mm-hmm. Have there been a lot of problems? There have been obviously enough of them noted over the years that you had to make some changes to close that loophole. What types of things have been documented that the veterans have noted to the VA about the problems that maybe they had in their education benefits?
Look, we're a very large organization. We have a really broad application in the higher level, higher learning institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's always things that don't go the way you want. So as we work with the IG, as we work with GAO, as we work with others, as we hear from veterans. We find out things that, hey, this really isn't working the way we need it to be. And then we go back in and change the rules to ensure that, number one, the funds are being expended the way Congress intended it to be, and number two, that veterans aren't being taken care of and that they're getting a really value-add quality education.
We're talking with Tom Murphy. He's the acting undersecretary for benefits for the Department of Veterans Affairs in Washington. And we've been talking about some big changes that have come about as a result of the American Rescue Plan of 2021. We've talked about educational benefits. We've talked about retraining benefits for veterans who need to look into a new career of some kind or another. Are there any other benefits that have made some big changes that are going to really affect veterans' lives we haven't mentioned?
Yeah, there's a really big one here. VA made a giant change in the way we processed when the COVID hit. We shut down our clinics, we stopped taking veterans in, and we reopened them to in-person examinations for medical examinations resulting from a claim that a veteran filed with the VA. In October, we opened up the in-person examinations again, and we've expanded that capability and continue to do so. We've also expanded the capability to get those examinations done inside of VHA. So the driver today for workforce to get decisions done out of the VA is veterans showing up to get their examinations done. So here's what's happened in the meantime. We set it up so it's a safe environment. We set it up with scheduling so that we don't have veterans in a waiting room together. There's distancing. We're sterilizing and cleaning in between appointments. And we're lining up the veterans one after another to come in. The veterans are now largely vaccinated. If they don't, they have the option to come in to VA. We'll vaccinate the veteran. We'll vaccinate their spouse. And we'll vaccinate their caregivers. Then come in, get your medical examinations done. And we have people ready to work those claims as soon as the medical examinations are done. So what can you do today to help speed the process? Contact the person that called you and said, I'm ready to take my medical examination now.
But sounds almost too simple. You think there must be some paperwork or something that'd be involved here. I know certainly you have to apply for some of the opportunities. When can veterans apply for this program?
Well, the VRAP program, you can call us at 1-800-MY-VA-411. Mm-hmm. You can come to our website, benefits.va.gov, or if you want, contact your local veteran service officer who will do those things for you and help you get into this program.
That's great. Now, if anybody is not aware, who is eligible for these opportunities?
This is targeted at veterans for 22 that are aged 22 to 67 years old and have lost their job as a result of COVID. Now, if you're already in school today going to the GI Bill, you're not eligible. If you are already today going through a program with our VR&E program, then you're not eligible. So this is targeted at the veteran that has no other options, that has lost their job and is financially impacted by the virus.
Well, it's certainly good to know, and I'm sure that there are probably thousands of veterans out there that are in that situation. They should certainly take advantage of this if they haven't done so already. Tom Murphy is the Acting Undersecretary for Benefits for the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, and he's been telling us about some of the great changes that have come about, transforming some veterans' lives, no doubt, because of the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021. Mr. Murphy, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Chris. You have a great day.
Thank you. You too. This is Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. There's a chance to find out a little bit of Lake County history if you go online, checking out a Facebook page and a YouTube channel. It's all about a project that is known as History Alive TV, and we have with us the fellow who's created all that and the series of documentaries that are out there, in particular the one that's out about the old Lake County Jail. Darren Zancan is with us to talk about it. Darren, thank you for joining us on the program.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit first about the ideas that put together the History Alive TV channels and where, in particular, the latest episode that's out there for you to see online about the old Lake County Jail came about.
Yeah, so I was in grad school at Northwestern in 2012, and one of my documentary projects was to just do a short documentary on something newsworthy of choice. And since I grew up in Lake Dale, just, you know, 8 minutes from the jail, mm-hmm. I knew the history of John Dillinger. I knew a little bit about the jail. And so I reached out to the historians at the jail and said, hey, can I come do this project for school? And at the time, they weren't really allowing people to come in and film, but I think I twisted their arm good enough to let me come in. And so I just did a short project for work on John Dillinger and kind of, you know, his story a little bit. And this was right around the time of Public Enemy, so it was a really good time to do it. And then they had said, "Hey, did you know this place is allegedly haunted?" And I'm like a journalist by trade. I'm not, I don't know, do I believe in ghosts or not? It's one of those things where it was more intriguing to learn, not necessarily like I believe that a ghost is going to throw me down the stairs or something like that. So I was like, sure, I'll come do a paranormal investigation. And so I went with them and we did that. And at one point I said, it'd be really cool in the future to do some type of historical paranormal show. And that was in 2012 that I said that. And then around 2018, my company, DMZ Productions, started kind of growing. And when I hired somebody full-time, we were looking at the old footage that I'd filmed very amateur during the paranormal investigation. And I stopped what we were doing. And I said, you know what? We're going to do the show. We're just going to do it right now. Looking at this footage is kind of inspiring me to do it. And so we dropped everything we were doing in that moment and kind of started focusing on History Alive. And the cool thing that a lot of people don't know about is Grant Wilson, who is Mr. Ghost Hunter, who started the TV show Ghost Hunters. He was living about 10 minutes from me in Richmond, Kentucky at the time, and we reached out to him, and he kind of helped us navigate and build and kind of plan the beginning of all of this. He gave us ideas, and then from there we started filming and building, and now we're here last night being the History Alive premiere of The Imprisoned, is what the episode's called, at the Lake County Jail.
Tell us about some of the other places that you've done so far, at least, and are planning at least to do, as are dealing with paranormal investigations.
So we started at Waveland State Historic Site. It's in Lexington, Kentucky. And then we transitioned to the second episode to Whitehall. Whitehall is where Cassius Clay, the original Cassius Clay, his family and estate was, and that's here in Richmond, Kentucky. Obviously, the jail, the Lake County Jail in Crown Point, Indiana. Then we have we've been in talks, and we're getting ready to, before COVID, obviously, we're planning to go to Rugby, Tennessee. That is, a lot of people claim it's the most haunted small town in America, about 2.5 hours south of us. We've been down there. We've kind of got a lay of the land. We also filmed segments at the Perryville Battlefield, which is one of the bloodiest battles in Civil War history. And then when we travel for other projects, we'll reach out to historical sites and we'll let them know what we're doing. And it seems like because our pitch is pretty strong and because we're based off history, this isn't a 100% a paranormal show. This is a very strong blend of, we look at history first. We research and we talk to historians and we learn about the artifacts and we learn about the people that either lived at this house or who were a part of this, facility. This being a jail, there was obviously inmates, but if you go to a historical house, it's family. And so there's a place called Belvoir Winery, which is Liberty, Missouri, that used to be a children's orphanage and a hospital. So we've been out there and we've filmed some there. We've been out to Salem, Massachusetts, and we filmed stuff at, where the Salem witch trials have been. So we've kind of been all over the country, kind of filming pieces here and there. But right now we've got three episodes done, a fourth one almost finished, and then Rugby is on the horizon, if COVID wouldn't have happened, we probably would have had that episode too.
Okay. Well, let's get back to the old Lake County Jail and the research that you all had done. You, of course, had personal research because of having lived here in Northwest Indiana. But what did you find out about some of the people, the inmates who inhabited the old jail? Probably just as notorious as the one that everybody knows about, and that is bank robber John Dillinger.
Yes, the thing is, everybody kind of sits on that. It's John Dillinger. He's obviously a very big name, and his name has even grown because of Johnny Depp and Public Enemies. But the thing is, he stayed there for a very short time. It wasn't like he was there for 10, 15 years where some of these other people have been there for months and years. He was there for a very small moment in history, but because his name value is so strong, people just think it's synonymous with the jail. But there's all these people that we, these notorious, you know, killers and just bad people, evil people that were there for a long time. And so learning about them, that was the focus, really. This whole show, there was maybe 2 to 3 minutes tops about John Dillinger. And then we focused really on these cast of criminals. You know, there's times that there were 500 people in that jail over several years. So if you think of how many thousands of people have come and gone, common felons, you know, things, people that were just doing common, like, robberies, you know, things that weren't horrific. And then there were really horrific moments like rape and, like, burying people alive and all these other, you know, really hellacious and heinous criminal activity. So it was a blend of all of these people, and we really got to learn a lot of history about these names that, you know, you don't hear about because John Dillinger kind of takes front and center.
Right. How much research did you have to do in getting prepared, especially for the old Bay County Jail episode?
Hours. I mean, hours and hours. We have historians, you know, we worked with Sandy Boyd, who's the president of the jail. You know, we worked with her. I sat down with her several days, and we went through archives and articles and every piece of historical information, obviously researching online, to our host of the show, Jeffrey. He is a historian, so he is researching. We don't turn our camera on until we know everything that we can possibly know about the time periods, the people who were there, because to us, it's very important that we make sure that we get history right. And there's a lot of people that are huge history fans, and if you get one thing wrong, they're gonna call you out on it because it's inaccurate, even from the way outfits were worn during certain periods. So we spend hours and hours and hours because we want to make sure it's right and that it's accurate and that you know, it's all put together the right way.
Did you have the opportunity in putting all this together for the presentation that's on the Facebook page and on the YouTube channel to be able, as you mentioned, about the research that you had to do, and of course making sure that the outfits and the costumes are right? Did you get to do many reenactments to go along with the storyline?
Yeah, that's always the fun part, because when it comes to the history, we reenact a few things. So we always reenact the history because it's important, again, to show people these moments in time. So the Raymond Carrs and the Ann Cunninghams and all of these people that are there, you know, we learn these stories, so we get the stories accurate, and then we reenact a lot of these moments. There was a couple people that tried to hang themselves in the jail, so there were segments with, you know, you see a noose and they're about to hang themselves. I mean, there's a lot of that in there. And then we also had reenactments with people who, I always say allegedly, because you don't, you know, it's everybody's take on something, but allegedly witnessed or saw something. So we would bring them in and kind of re-walk through their moments, and then you take all that, put it all together, and then you have a paranormal investigation. So it's all of these pieces. And then we have narration, which, you know, makes it, I think, a lot different than a lot of these other paranormal shows, because it is rooted in history, but then we have a narrator along with tons and tons of interviews that are guiding people through this period of time.
Now, I know that you have it on the Facebook and on the YouTube channel, but are you hoping that maybe that this series, History Alive and ones in the future, will end up on some streaming service?
Yeah, that's our goal. I mean, we're working on this project. We have another a comedy series called The Home. It's about life in a nursing home. I worked at a nursing home in Indiana for a while, and all these stories I kind of started writing down. And so we're creating two totally different shows. And so our goal is to really have a really strong portfolio and with the people involved to get it. I love right now this time in TV history, because I always tell people, if we were doing History Live in the Home 10 years ago, you had cable. That was it. It was cable, and Netflix was still just kind of like a red box where you could watch a movie. Now you have all of these options for people to watch wherever they want to watch. And so I'm really excited, because I think we have such a unique opportunity to get what we're working on in front of a lot of eyes. And so that is our end goal, is to get it to the best possible place so that people can really experience, you know, what we're doing.
Darren Zancan is owner of DMZ Productions. He's a Northwest Indiana native from Lake County, as a matter of fact. He's put out, among other things, a series which is called History Alive, and the latest episode that is out there to see on Facebook and on YouTube, and the YouTube channel is about the old Lake County Jail. Darren, thank you very much for telling us about not only your company, about the history and the research that you did in putting out the latest episode about the old Lake County Jail, and good luck on the others coming up.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
On Thursdays, we like to check in with reporters here in Northwest Indiana to find out more about the stories they've put out in print and online. And Hannah Reed, who's a freelance reporter for the Post Tribune, is with us today. Thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
We had three interesting stories that have come out in print and online. One of them deals with the legislature and education, and a couple others and dealing with life after the worst, we hope, of the pandemic. Let's talk first about the measure that went through the General Assembly and how a longtime General Assembly member from Northwest Indiana is not quite sure about it. Tell us what State Representative Werner Smith had to say about the measure that involves teachers.
Yeah, so Senate Bill 205 was signed by Holcomb into law on April 22nd, and it was a bill that Smith has long contested. And basically what it will do is it will allow for an alternate path for people who are trying to receive a teacher's license. And it'll be a faster way to get a teacher into the classroom, but Smith's concern is that it will not hit some key qualifications that are needed for educators to be able to give the quality of instruction that is needed.
Well, tell us about this measure that was introduced and passed here that would involve the Indiana Department of Education and this alternative route to getting teachers into the classrooms.
Yeah, so the bill would require the Department of Education to provide an initial practitioner license to an individual that completes an alternative teacher certification program. And it'll require teacher preparation program to include curriculum that instructs teachers about social emotional learning practices that are helpful in supporting students who have experienced trauma. But while, you know, it'll do all that, what Smith has said is that it may assist in the teacher shortage throughout Indiana, but it doesn't require certain GPA standards, field experience, or student teaching that other students will be going through that are not going through the program with the bill.
Mm-hmm. Is Representative Smith mostly concerned not only about making sure that teachers get the proper pay for their experience, and that's it, not only experience in college but also in the classroom, but just in general that maybe there needs to be a bit more equity in the whole overall issue?
Yeah, he said that you know, this will help get a body in the classroom, but overall that person may not be prepared to do, you know, the best job instructing the children in the classroom to increase student learning. So while they'll be, you know, learning valuable things through this, they may not be learning exactly what their counterparts are learning, and it may not be, I guess, as high of or as the best job of instructing mm-hmm. the children, if that makes sense.
Now, I know this has been in your story, have had some reaction to all of this, and particularly the bill that's now passed from the Gary Community School Corporation. Had a chance to talk with Kimberly Bradley, who's the chief academic officer over at the Gary School District. What does she have to say about this measure, and what in turn is going to mean for being able to get more teachers in, for example, into the Gary School District?
Gary Community School Corporation is, you know, like many school districts across the state, has been hit by the teacher shortage. And, you know, this bill attempts to address the concern regarding that. So, you know, Bradley had said this will definitely help, you know, get individuals into the classroom, and, you know, some positives of the language of the bill, she said, were the requirements that teachers, you know, will be trained in trauma-informed practices and social-emotional learning. So, you know, they'll be able to do that. But Bradley did say the Gary School District will continue to, you know, invest in their current and new teachers and work to attract, you know, the best candidates for their students in order to get, you know, the best people into their classrooms.
We're talking to Hannah Reed, who's a freelance reporter for the Post Tribune, about the story she has out in print and online. And a couple stories here deal with life after the worst of the pandemic and trying to get things back at least into the new normal. And that includes live shows. Maybe we'll have venues across Northwest Indiana that'll be open again for audiences. Will you tell us about that?
Yeah, so what we're seeing, you know, through the state now is venues and different, you know, bars and restaurants and things are beginning to open for more capacity as vaccines are rolled out and restrictions are lifted in Indiana. You know, the state's 8-month mask mandate became advisory as of last month, and business owners are now able to decide limits on capacity and whether or not they're going to require masks and things like that. And so, you know, many are returning for the first time in a long time to having live music performances and, you know, having those little shows at the venues. And they're not the, you know, ginormous venues that concerts are at, but more of like pub shows and things like that. And they're able to, you know, return to those live performances for people during the week, on the weekends and things like that.
I know some places in particular, you checked in at Duffy's Place, which is a place in Valparaiso. And what did the owner have to say about bringing shows back into his establishment and audiences too?
Yeah, so Duffy's Place is currently open at 100%, and that's what the owner, Jeff Aubin, said. And they have live bands every Friday and Saturday. And he said that, you know, customers and employees have both been excited about this change, and they have outdoor seating. And you know, he said a few people here and there still wear masks at Duffy's Place. But, you know, he finds that just employees are happy to be back serving and bartending and letting customers make up their mind about masks.
One of the other stories that you also had in print and out there online about the post-pandemic life talks also about maybe the possibility that we may have some county fairs back in business again. Tell us about the one that you checked into in the story about the Lake County Fair.
Yeah, so the Lake County Fair, as of right now, they have plans to be open, you know, as traditional as possible this summer. I spoke to the Tom Lumps, the president of the Lake County Fair, and he said they are hoping, you know, it'll be the 169th edition of the fair, and they are really hoping that, you know, it'll be able to be as normal as possible. And they don't know exactly what the requirements will be. There may be, you know, people may have to wear masks. There may be more hand sanitizers and things like that. But as of right now, they're looking at doing the fair as traditionally as it has been in the past.
What kind of planning can they do, or have they done at least up to now, as much as they can do, and not knowing what all the restrictions may be?
So something that Lump said was that it is hard to fully plan the fair this year because of the fact that, you know, there's no way to determine how the pandemic will look in the summer months. And he did say that, you know, last year a lot of planning went into the fair, and then, like many other fairs, it ended up having to be canceled. So it's hard to plan for exact precautions when they're not sure exactly what they'll be yet. So just looking forward, I believe that they're planning it in the best way that they can in terms of, you know, what they've been given with the precautions.
Now, how about the vendors that we always enjoy seeing and enjoying the food that they put out at the fair every year? What do some of the vendors have to say?
Doris Stringer, the owner of Dory's Food Stuff Trailers, who is from Valparaiso, has done the Lake County Fair for many years and has been in the business for 40 years. And she said she's really looking forward to, you know, getting back to normal. Again, like Lump said, she's not exactly sure about, you know, what the rules will be in terms of, you know, I guess masks and things like that. And she knows that there's going to be different rules for vendors that they'll have to follow. But she said she's excited to, you know, see her regulars at the fair, such as the workers. And, you know, it'll, even with the potential rules and regulations and how things may look different, she said she is just glad that they're able to, you know, return to the fair.
Hannah Reed is a freelance reporter for the Post Tribune and had stories out in print and online here, not only about life after the pandemic subsides some, but also a look at education here in Northwest Indiana. And as always, Hannah, thanks for joining us, and would look forward to having you back on again soon. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte, and for this week, we should mention, on our thanks to Porter County Sheriff Dave Reynolds, Tom Murphy, the Acting Undersecretary for Benefits by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, filmmaker and region native Dan Zancam, and with Post Tribune freelance reporter Hannah Reed. And thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you on Monday.